from KQED.
This is the California Report podcast. I'm Lily Jamali. As wildfires in our state become more frequent and more destructive, California's two utility giants are laying out plans for dealing with them. SoCal Edison is saying they would like to spend almost $600 million on a host of measures that include more inspections and more cameras, among others. State regulators would have to approve if they can pass that cost onto ratepayers and how much. The utility has told regulators its equipment experienced an outage in the run-up to last month's Woolsey fire. Further north, PG&E is saying it wants to step up its safety measures, saying it will start inspecting thousands more miles of power lines. A law passed earlier this year calls for utilities to share wildfire prevention plans with the state's Public Utilities Commission. Well, the aftermath of the Camp Fire has Butte County officials concerned about the budget there. Property taxes were due yesterday, and they are reassessing property values for the thousands who lost their homes. Now, keep in mind, finances were already tight. They shut down one of their 10 fire stations to get through last year's budget. Local Assemblyman James Gallagher has introduced AB 42 to help the county deal with a thinner tax base. I spoke with him about it.
AB 42 is really geared at tax stabilization. So if you could imagine for a moment that the city or town that you live in is completely wiped out, you know, it's going to be many years before people rebuild, let alone start going to the grocery stores and going out to restaurants. All those things are gone. Because nobody's doing that, there's no tax base for instance, the town of Paradise.
And so, Assemblyman, how does this bill, AB 42, address that?
So AB 42 then would provide a backfill of the revenues for local governments and schools, local utilities that help support the towns that have been wiped out, and ensure that they are funded so that they can carry out all the functions that they're going to need to carry out. We are trying to get something over the next 3 years because it is going to take some time. We're hoping to get a commitment, you know, from the state to cover those, you know, cover a more extended period.
And where does the money come from? Does it come from a fund that already exists, or do you expect you'll issue new bonds to pay for this?
There is some emergency money that can be freed up and supplied to help communities like mine. But also it's going to require a budget commitment. And so it's something that in the budget this year we would be seeking funding for as well.
And that was Republican Assemblyman James Gallagher, who represents Butte County. Here in San Francisco, a special panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals just reheard a case that could have consequences for thousands of kids seeking asylum in the U.S. At issue is whether those children have a right to an attorney. KQED's Julie Small reports.
A teenager with the initial CJ fled Honduras when a gang threatened to recruit him at gunpoint. He asked for asylum in the U.S., but was rejected. Attorneys with the ACLU of Southern California have appealed that decision. Ahilin Arulanam told the court Monday that the immigration judge who rejected CJ's claim failed to tell the teenager that he was likely eligible for residency under a program for juveniles. CJ's case, he said, is a good example of why children in immigration proceedings need attorneys.
Most of these children are eligible for some form of relief in the current system. And if they're going to have any serious possibility of obtaining it, they need legal representation.
U.S. Attorney Scott Stewart told the 11-judge panel that kids in immigration court have no constitutional right to an attorney, regardless of their case or their age.
Your Honor, I don't know. I couldn't commit to a particular case where it would be constitutionally required to appoint counsel.
That response elicited disbelief from some of the judges who doubted whether a toddler as young as two or a baby could get a fair hearing on their own. A ruling is expected in the next several months. For the California Report, I'm Julie Small.
U.S. Border Patrol agents arrested more than 30 people at a protest along the San Diego-Tijuana border on Monday. Our partners at KPBS in San Diego report that the rally, organized by a group of Quakers, drew hundreds of people. A Border Patrol spokesperson says most were arrested for trespassing, one for assaulting an officer. This is the Border Patrol's second confrontation with protesters since members of the migrant caravan started arriving in Tijuana last month. Meanwhile, nonprofit groups in San Diego have been sheltering Central American asylum seekers since the end of October, when a longstanding policy was abruptly changed by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Now, these groups are running out of resources, and they're asking the state government to step in. Reporter Max Rivlin-Nadler has more.
In late October, the San Diego Rapid Response Network, a coalition of nonprofit groups that supports immigrants, received a tip on their 24-hour hotline about something alarming a caller was seeing.
We just saw what looks like a Department of Homeland Security bus, a big white bus with an emblem, drop off about 30-something people at the Greyhound on Commercial and 13th.
Norma Chavez-Peterson leads the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial Counties, a core partner of the Rapid Response Network. At a press conference last week, she explained how ICE had abruptly stopped coordinating for the travel needs of asylum seekers when they're released from custody. They were being left with no money and no way to reunite with family or their sponsors. Within hours, the Rapid Response Network sprang into action.
So volunteers went, and from there we took them to the first shelter, which was at a Methodist church.
Since that night, the network has sheltered over 1,700 people, all families, and help them connect with their relatives or sponsors. In statements, ICE said it no longer has the capacity to provide travel assistance to asylum seekers and is in touch with local groups providing shelter. But with little help so far from state and local officials, the organizations behind the shelter are running low on funds.
Even if we get donations, even if we have volunteers, you're looking at about $350,000 a month.
Last week, officials from the cities of San Diego, Chula Vista, and National City sent a letter to the state requesting assistance. For the California Report, I'm Max Rivlin-Nadler in San Diego.
Let's go to the northeast corner of the state now. The U.S. Forest Service will temporarily stop selling wild horses to buyers who would send them to slaughter. The move comes after the American Wild Horse Campaign sued the agency, which rounded up almost 1,000 horses this fall in the Modoc National Forest. KQED's Penny Nelson has the latest.
The task before officials is to find homes for as many of those captured horses as possible. Ken Sandusky is with the U.S. Forest Service.
There's still some pretty good horses, though they are older. People have a lot of good things to say about their ability to train them, get them under saddle, and just making good riding animals out of them with less investment than other wild horse herds.
The need to bring the number of wild horses down is not in dispute. There are 4,000 horses running wild in an area biologists say can sustain about 400. Officials say the overpopulation is taking a toll on the land on Devil's Garden Plateau in Modoc County, where the horses live. The fate of the captured horses is the source, though, of ongoing controversy. And now new state legislation, due to Forest Service plans to sell unadopted horses at very low cost, which makes them vulnerable to sale for slaughter. San Diego Assemblyman Todd Gloria has introduced a bill which would strengthen existing laws preventing the horses from being sold to slaughter for human consumption. He joined Senator Dianne Feinstein and nearly two dozen state lawmakers opposing these types of sales. For the California Report, I'm Penny Nelson.
Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems. The James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. And Collective Health. American employers are in the healthcare business. It's time they had the technology to drive it. CollectiveHealth.com.
The FDA's initial advisory last month on romaine lettuce dealt a big blow to farmers. The FDA has narrowed its search for the source of the E. coli outbreak to central and northern California. KAZU's Erica Mahoney has more on a new approach aimed at trying to limit losses the next time.
At a landfill in Monterey County, compactors with spiky wheels help bury a pungent pile of trash.
I've been flabbergasted by the amount of romaine that's been coming in, and I can only imagine it's the tip of the iceberg.
Angela Goble of the Monterey Regional Waste Management District says about 125 tons of romaine have wound up in the district's landfill so far. Most of it was packaged. That means it has to go to the landfill because the plastic can't be composted.
I want to go and pull apart the packaging myself so it can be composted.
The FDA's initial advisory to throw out all romaine hit farmers here in the Salinas Valley hard. But members of the United Fresh Produce Association, an industry trade group, say a new labeling system could help. Some ag companies have started tagging romaine products with information on where they were grown and when they were harvested. So the hope is in a future outbreak, consumers would only have to throw away lettuce from affected areas. In this case, the FDA says don't eat romaine from central and northern California. Joe Pizzini is the president and CEO of Ocean Mist Farms in Castroville, about half an hour north of Monterey. He's embracing the labeling idea.
We look at it as acres, and I mean many, many acres were thrown away. And now you magnify that across the supply chain, so every warehouse across the country, every grocery store, I mean that's a massive amount of product.
The leafy greens industry is creating a task force to see if this kind of labeling should stick around. For the California Report, I'm Erica Mahoney in Monterey County.
Okay, we're going to switch gears now. Take a listen to this.
California Reportiman Alin Hamoskai.
That's Welcome to the California Report in Quechua, an indigenous language spoken by around 8 million people, primarily in Peru, Bolivia, and Ecuador. KQED's Hope McKenney brings us the story of a woman who teaches Quechua here in the Bay Area.
Yao, yao, puka puyiracha. Yao, yao, puka puyiracha. Imataruwanki chakrayu.
Marisol Necochea was born in the 1970s in the mountains of southern Peru, in the region of Apurimac, which means where the gods speak. Her parents, a farmer and a shopkeeper, spoke both Spanish and Quechua, but wanted their 11 children to assimilate.
When we were children, they didn't want us to learn Quechua. They didn't want us to speak Quechua. They always told us, in many moments, don't speak Quechua because you're going to confuse your Spanish.
Although about half the population of the Central Andes is indigenous, speaking native languages has always been seen as inferior. Even in school, Necochea and her siblings were physically punished if they were caught speaking Quechua. However, she learned the language of the Inca Empire anyway.
We learned Quechua from the elders in our town who came to help my mother. They spoke more Quechua than Spanish.
Necochea moved to the Bay Area 17 years ago, and a few years ago she began teaching Quechua at Stanford University.
Thank God I learned Quechua. It's because of that that I'm now at Stanford teaching students of this generation, and it makes me incredibly happy to do that.
She says the language that opened this door for her is incredibly rich. It even has its own tense to talk about dreams and altered states, and she can communicate certain feelings she can't express in Spanish or English. Now Necochea speaks Quechua openly with her parents, and they say they are proud of her for being a teacher at one of the most prestigious universities in the United States. They come to visit her every few years, and when they say farewell to each other, they use a common Quechua send-off.
Tu pananchikama. Hasta nuestro próximo encuentro. See you next time.
Until then, for the California Report, I'm Hope McKenney.
Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems. The James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. And Collective Health. American employers are in the healthcare business. It's time they had the technology to drive it. Collectivehealth.com.
And that's the California Report for this Tuesday, December 11th. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Lily Jamali. Have a great day.